Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Oh, hello everybody. Welcome back to New Books Network. I'm Shuwan. Today I feel very happy to invite Dr. Xinfan to discuss his newest book, World History and the National Identity in China. The first thing I want to do is just invite Dr. Fan to introduce himself to us.
Oh, thank you very much for your invitation, Shuwan. This is Xinfan speaking, Dr. Xinfan. I'm a historian of 20th century China. I do world history, I do Chinese history, but I also do a little reception studies. In the past, I co-edited a book on the receptions of Greek and Roman antiquity in East Asia. And today, we're going to talk about my monograph, World History and National Identity in China. As a historian, I grew up in China. I was educated in the United States, in Germany. Now I'm working in the United Kingdom. I'm a teaching associate at in the Faculty of Asian and Middle Eastern Studies at Cambridge University, but I'm also a fellow and director of studies at Lucy Cavendish College. Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Thank you so much. So next question, I want to ask you the reason why you are interested in the research project of the relationship between national identity and world history in China.
Thank you very much for the question. This is a great question because when I was writing the book, it's really difficult to get myself involved into the conversation, right, in the book. But this is a great opportunity for me to share some of my personal experience, the reason why I was doing this project. There are a couple of reasons. I think fundamentally, this goes back to the issue of identity. I was educated in China. And when I was studying in China, my major is world history. And in China, studying world history, sometimes there was a little confusion in terms of what I was doing. Because on the one hand, I'm doing a study of the world. On the other hand, I'm Chinese. So what does world history mean to myself, to the people in China? And especially when I was doing the undergraduate training, and in the same way at the graduate school, there's always this sort of feeling that in China, world history does not include China. So in other words, for some reason, it seems that world history in China becomes a foreign history. And that's the fundamental question that pushed me to start this project. That is, I want to understand why world history becomes foreign history in this country. And of course, while I was doing this project, then this is not just a question of historiography, right? This is not just a question about the division between world historical studies and the Chinese historical studies. It is more than history. It is fundamentally, this is a question, a critical question to the identity formation process in China, and I would argue over the course of the 20th century. So while I was doing this this topic about historiography, world history in China, gradually, I just realized that I had to talk about bigger issues, like social, cultural, and political issues that created the context for the rise of world history in China and the process within which world history became foreign history in China. So in the beginning, it was a personal project, but then gradually it became a project that goes beyond historiography. It becomes a question, an inquiry into the collective identity formation process in China in the country.
Thank you so much for your answer again. So now let's turn to your book. So my first question is regards your first chapter of the book. I want to invite you to share your thought about what historical writing that emerged in China in the early 20th century after the rise of print capitalism as an attempt to address concern about global space.
Oh, thank you very much. This book is, I guess, fundamentally, it is a book about the formation of world historical discipline in China. So in other words, it's a history of a discipline. And that discipline is called world history. But then while I was doing that, I was struggling with the beginning of this project. So where should I start? And of course, you can see the first chapter talks about the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century. And in that chapter, I was dealing with the origins of world historical studies in China. And it's a difficult question because if we think about world history, in a way, world history always existed in China. If we go back to Sima Qian, right, the grand historian, and he already touched on some world historical issues. And there are some really respectful comparative studies between world historical traditions in ancient China and in other parts of the world. So the origin is a very challenging issue. But then in this project, on the one hand, I'm dealing with the historiographical issue of world history. But on the other hand, I'm also dealing with the social issue, the question of the socialized production of knowledge. So in that case, I'm also dealing with the history of the world history discipline. And in that case, I guess the first chapter is the right beginning for the rise of world historical discipline, which I argue is started in the beginning of the 20th century and perhaps by the end of the 19th century. So that's something I was trying to do in this project. That is, I would like to pinpoint to the beginning of world history discipline in China. And of course, in that process, as you rightfully mentioned, that the rise of print capitalism had a lot to do with the rise of the academic discipline of world history in China. So there are a couple of things I would like to say. One is when we are dealing with the issue of world history in the beginning of the 20th century China, there was this ambiguous and complicated transformation from the traditional historical thinking into so-called modern historiography. So in other words, the early individuals who were trying to write about the world history, so-called world history in China at that time, they were dealing with the heritage of Neo-Confucianism. So in other words, to put it simple, that is, how can you write a world history that is similar to world history in other parts of the world in the 20th century, at the same time, you are also dealing with the legacy of traditional historiography. So in other words, I'm trying to reconcile the tension between tradition and the modernity in the first chapter. So the rise of print capitalism, I would argue, is a signature moment for the rise of a modern sense of world history in China. But at the same time, you can see I'm struggling a little bit, right, dealing with the legacy issue. So and that's the reason I'm looking at the people who were writing about world history at the moment in China. They were not professional historians yet. They were gentry scholars of the time. And they received the Confucian education. And in fact, they were while they were writing about the world, they did not give up on Confucian tradition. And they were trying to find a way to reconcile the tension between tradition and modernity, so much so they would use Confucianism as the sort of ideological foundation, right, for them to talk about things in the world. So it's a complicated process. And in this process, I'm not giving up on the influence of traditional Chinese historiography. I'm not giving up on the influence of Neo-Confucianism. But at the same time, I would also like to acknowledge the impact of the so-called modern world. And specifically is what you mentioned, the rise of print capitalism. Let me just bring up another perspective on this. That is, by the turn of the 20th century, it was a time of a fundamental change in terms of the education system in China. The civil examination system was about to be abolished. In fact, it was abolished in 1905. And by doing so, because of that, right? So the meaning of world history or history education had transformed. And the old way of writing history became sort of obsolete. And then the gentry scholar at the time, they were trying to come up with something new and to talk about world history in the form of textbooks. And they wrote world history because they wanted to publish these world history books as textbooks. And the rise of textbooks were driven by the rise of print capitalism. I'm sorry, a little bit complicated here, but I'm dealing with a very complicated issue.
Thank you so much for your answer. So for my next question, I want to invite you to talk about how the Chinese world history's pursuit of intellectual autonomy was interrupted by the war with Japan.
Oh yeah, that is a very important question. So as I mentioned, the first chapter of this book talks about this complicated origin of world historical writings at the turn of the 20th century in China. And the second chapter, in that chapter, I'm dealing with the issue of world historical education in the Republican period in China. And pretty much we're looking at the early 10s all the way to 1949. And you're right. One dominant theme for that chapter is the rise and the fall of the pursuit of intellectual autonomy. But I would like to argue that the pursuit of intellectual autonomy, it is not just a simple idea or simple performance by Chinese intellectuals as individual self. Rather, it is something that is tied up to the bigger changes in Chinese society. And that is the rise of a professional education and the professional research of history. So in other words, we're really dealing with the process of professionalization of historical study and historical education in the Republican period in China. And within that bigger picture, I would argue, so for the process of professionalization, it is a social process, right? You can see in the past, historians, a lot of people, they were gentry scholars. I mean, they wrote about history, but they also wrote many other things. In a way, their knowledge is comprehensive, at least what they were trying to do, right? They were doing philosophy, they were doing literature, they were doing history. But by the time of the 1910s, especially 1916, when Cai Yuanpei returned to become chancellor at Peking University, the the education system in China gradually transformed into one so-called modern. So the rise of a modern education system under the bigger changes, right? This sort of sociological changes, historians became professionals. They became academic professionals. And because of that, they had this very clear goal that what they were doing was scientific, right? So as a historian, they were thinking, right, what I'm doing is a scientific pursuit. In other words, what I'm trying to do is real knowledge, pure knowledge. It has nothing to do with other parts of the world. You know, it's not related to politics. It is not related to economy. It's just what I'm trying to do, right? Pure scholarship. In fact, I'll give you one example, right? Historian Gu Jiegang, who was a big name in the Republican period in China. And he once wrote in his diary saying, well, today someone else told me that they overheard a conversation on the bus. So like they random conversation. In that conversation, person A said to person B, I do not like Gu Jiegang. Because Gu Jiegang said, right, I can write history under the dragon fly. So in other words, I can write history in the Qing dynasty. And Gu Jiegang also said, I can write history under the warlord rule. So in the military control, I'm still writing history. And I'm writing history the same way as, right, so in the warlord time or in the royal dynasty, right, I'm writing history the same way. And this person A said, this is the reason I don't like Gu Jiegang. Because you know, he thinks that what he does has nothing to do with the political changes. And the person B said, "Well, yeah, I agree. This is the reason why Lu Xun doesn't like him, right?" And Gu Jiegang wrote in the diary, said, "Well, this I didn't say any of this. So this conversation is really just rumor, based on rumors. But at the same time, I could have said that. In other words." Indeed, this is my opinion, right? What I'm trying to do is to build a scholarly society in China, 学术社会. And that scholarly society is based on the pure pursuit of knowledge, has nothing to do with politics. And that reflects the zeitgeist of the entire generation in the 1910s and 1920s. But then, as you rightly point out, that things start to change, because even like people like Gu Jiegang, right, they were trying to pursue intellectual autonomy, they were trying to pursue pure knowledge, pure scholarship. However, the social and political environment in China had such profound impact on their individual existence. So much so that Gu Jiegang had to run away when the Japanese took over Beijing, because he believed that his name was on the blacklist of the Japanese army. So he had to run away. And in fact, he himself would argue that after what happened in China in 1937, he would argue, well, now I'm not going to pursue pure knowledge. Now I'm going to pursue history as a weapon to shape national identity in China. So this is a story about Gu Jiegang, but this is also a shared experience of the entire generation of historians in China in the Republican period, right, from the 19th decade to the Japanese invasion of China. And in this chapter, I'm dealing with historian Lei Haizong. And in the 1920s, 1930s, he was a very influential figure in world history education. He served as chair of the history department at Tsinghua University, which is one of the most influential universities in China back then and in China even today. So he served as chair of the history department at Tsinghua University. And he's also a world historian. He teaches world history and the general history of the world, but he also teaches a general history of China. As a chair of the history department, he in the 1930s, he wrote, well, as like Chinese universities provide too much education on world history, right? Our students have to take so many courses on world history, more than those people in Harvard, right? In the elite universities in the United States. So in a way, he's trying to think, right, the development of world history as a discipline. And he's sharing the responsibility as a scholar, shaping the national curriculum, right? Shaping the conversation about history education. That's 1930s. But by the time of 1940s, when the Japanese invaded China, when he had to run away from Beijing, right, join the others in Kunming to join the Southwest Associated University, where the Japanese airplanes were bombing, right, Kunming all the time. By that time, right, his idea about world history had already changed. Now he would argue, well, world history is important too for us to consolidate national identity in the time of war. And they would argue China was weak because China did not have a consolidated identity. And as historians, they would argue, they would use history as a weapon to help the nation to become even more unified, to mobilize individuals, to create a strong collective voice, right? And they would use world history as a weapon to shake up national spirit. Right? So that's what I'm trying to argue in the second chapter of the book.
Okay, thank you so much for your answer. So now let's turn to the third chapter. For this one, I want to invite you to discuss the paradox facing world history and Lin Zhicun and Tong Shuye as they try to negotiate this emerging and complex academic and political environment.
Thank you very much. This book follows a chronological order. The first chapter talks about the turn of the 20th century. In other words, the majority conversation goes to late Qing. And the second chapter covers the Republican period. And the third chapter talks about what happened to world historians in the early People's Republic of China, in other words, 1950s. And here, I have two chapters. Chapter three deals with the collective biography, what happened to people who were doing world history in China in the 1950s. And then the next chapter, chapter four, deals with the historiography, that is what they wrote about in terms of world history and what they were debating about. So what is the key issue, right? What is the key issue in the conversation? And that conversation eventually shaped the foundation of world historical studies in China. So these two chapters are in a way, both deal with 1950s. And specifically for this chapter, chapter three, I'm dealing with the issue of individual agency, individual choice. Because world history, as I wrote, and as you have already mentioned, started with this effort to pursue pure knowledge in the 1920s, right? So it has its legacy, right? Historians wanted to pursue pure scholarship. But by the 1950s, the Communist Party took over China. And the party's understanding of historiography is different from these intellectuals in the 1920s in China. The party clearly believed, or maybe still believes, that history is a tool to shape the national identity, but it is also a tool to mobilize the masses. And that's the reason the party had a clear agenda to transform world history as a discipline in the country. In other words, the party wanted to reform the individuals who were doing world historical education, world historical research in China for the purpose of the construction of a socialist state. And the key goal is the indoctrination of Marxist ideology. So this is the bigger picture. And then within that big picture, what happens, what happened to those individuals? And in that chapter, I'm dealing with four individuals, and they came from different origins, and they had a different ideological identifications. Some of them were more sympathetic with the communist movement before the revolution, and some of them were more hesitant to embrace socialist ideas. So we're looking at the tension and the different trajectories of these world, so-called world historians in China. Specifically, as you mentioned, I'm dealing with two important individuals. One is Lin Zhichun, who nowadays is considered the founding father of ancient world historical studies in China. And Tong Shuyue is the other person you mentioned, who is who was trained by Gu Jiegang and started his work as a historian of ancient China. But by the time of 1950s, he was converted into ancient world history. So here you see I'm introducing a new word, ancient world history. So in other words, when I'm dealing with world history in China, this is a very big field, right? Today in China, at least one-third, maybe one-half of historians belong to world history. This is a very big field. It's a massive amount of data. If someone wants to write a history of a world history discipline in China. So this is a really big field. And this is the reason I have this strategy when I'm writing the book. That is, I choose a small division, a small group of people who are doing so-called ancient world history in China. 世界古代史. And specifically, right, by definition, ancient world history deals with anything before the arrival of the Dark Ages, the Middle Ages, from the global perspective. So in other words, these people were studying ancient antiquity in the West as well as in the East. And within this field, these two individuals, Tong Shuye and Lin Zhichun, became very interesting. Both of them studied the Chinese history before the Communist Revolution. And both of them were converted into world historians after the Communist takeover. And both of them were sympathetic with this sort of transformation. And here I see many reasons. And maybe they were truly interested in world history. But at the same time, there were also opportunities for them to take advantage of, right? Because ancient world history by the 1950s was relatively a new field. And the state really supported the development of the field. So a lot of resources would be pouring into this new field, and they would take the opportunity to do it. So they found opportunities themselves. But by doing so, I would argue they gradually became generally interested in ancient world history. So that's the story we're looking at, right? Not only we're looking at the people who were very hesitant about this sort of socialist transformation, but also I'm actually looking at the people who were quite active and positive about this transformation. And that's the biography, collective biography we're looking at about these two individuals.
Thank you so much for your answer again. So my next question is about chapter 4 of your book. For this one, I want to invite you to discuss the reason why many Chinese historians choose to dismiss the universal reason exposed by Chinese world history as a false analogy.
Yeah, that's right. The next chapter still deals with 1950s. And here the idea is 1950s was a critical moment for the rise of world history as a discipline in China. There are many reasons for that, and one of the important reasons is the restructuring of China's higher education system according to the Soviet model. So in other words, the whole world history discipline in China today is still carrying on the legacy from the socialist period. And that legacy actually was modeled on the Soviet Union. World history, in a way, in China is very similar to the socialist legacy from the Soviet Union. But that process is a political, social process. I would argue this social and political process transformation would also have impact on people's understanding of ideas, knowledge production. And that's the reason I'm dividing 1950s into two periods, two chapters. The first chapter, as I mentioned, deals with the people, what happened to the people, the collective biography of the people. The second chapter, that's chapter four, deals with what happened to the ideas, to the knowledge production process. And there are two things I was trying to write about. The second thing is your question, but allow me to introduce the first thing first, right? There are two things. The first thing is, under the socialist regime, was there good history, right? So in China today and in many other places, a lot of people have this assumption that is historical work has to be undertaken through the process of autonomous knowledge production. So in other words, historians must be able to exercise their free will so that they can produce good history. And that is very much true. That is very much so. But then the question here is, what if historians unfortunately are being placed in the time that they do not have the luxury to exercise free thinking? Are they going to write history? Are they going to write good history? Or are they going to write bad history? And of course, a lot of people will say, well, the historical writing in that period is really ideological, right? Some people would argue world historical writing in the 1950s serves as a handmaiden of political ideology. In a way, it is true. But at the same time, what I'm trying to look at in this period is the dynamics. That is, on the one hand, there is ideological control. On the other hand, historians, they're still people. By nature, they would like to pursue the exercise of free thinking, even under difficult times. And that is what we're looking at the community of world historians in China. That is, the individuals, they were still trying to look for meaningful conversation despite all the ideological concerns. And eventually, they found a way to do it. That is, to discuss the question of Asia, the question of Asia, Asiatic mode of production, Asiatic mode of production. It's a very, very bizarre concept coming from a socialist and Marxist historiography. And we don't have time to go too much into this. But the fundamental question here is whether or not China, as an Asian country, had a unique trajectory of historical development. And this, they chose this question maybe subconsciously, but by applying some ideas from post-colonial studies, I would urge you, the question about Asia the issue of the relationship between European history and Asian history is an ambiguous point in Marx's historiography. Karl Marx did not really clearly explain everything, and Stalin did not really have a concrete answers for all these ideological debates regarding the relationship between the East and the West. And because the ideological legacy in this area, the relationship between the East and the West, is so weak, so ambiguous, that allows people, the historians in China, even under the tight control for Marxist ideology, they could still exercise a little bit of free thinking. And in this case, in this chapter, I'm dealing with the debate about whether or not China in the past had a unique trajectory of historical development. So this is the first part, right? The second part goes back to your important question. That is, what happens to that community, this community of world historians? They were trying to pursue this sort of interesting debate regarding the nature of the relationship between the ancient East and the ancient West, China and Asia and Europe, right? They were trying to have that sort of summer conversation. But what happened to the reception of this sort of a dialogue and conversation? And I would argue, this is really the legacy or the baggage that they are carrying. That is, for a lot of historians outside of field of world history, like Chinese historians or historians who were studying ancient China or modern China, right, these people would be very hesitant to accept a group of scholars who were historians because the state wanted them to be so, right? So in that case, the world historians became outsiders to the historians community in China. But under the tide of ideological control, historians, especially Chinese historians or historians who were studying China, right, they would be very hesitant to directly challenge world history. And they would be very hesitant to challenge what the world historian in China they were trying to do was not historical, right? So they would be very difficult because the consequences will be there, right? So that's the reason they cannot directly say, you guys are not doing good history. But a way to get around to this is they could argue, well, you're doing great work, but it is not relevant to China. So in other words, in that intricate moment of the 1950s, under the intensified tension between history and ideology, some historians adopted the discourse of cultural difference as a way to define right, their intellectual autonomy. By rejecting world history, their secret agenda, or maybe a hidden agenda, would be, if we follow the line of thought, right? If world history does not apply to China, how about Marxism as foreign ideas? Would that be able to apply to China? So that sort of conversation, they can now say that a lot. And they can now say Marxism is not relevant to China. But they can at least make this argument, Chinese history is so unique that the world historical perspectives do not necessarily apply to our country. So in the moment of the tension between ideological concerns and historical pursuits, this idea of nationalism actually became sort of a defensive mechanism that allows Chinese historians to at least define their intellectual autonomy. So this is a little bit complicated argument here, but I hope I can explain that relatively clear to you. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much for your answer again. So now let's turn to chapter 5. For this chapter, my question is that I want to invite you to talk about your argument that Chairman Mao's death, world historical study in China witnessed a new wave a professionalization within the Marxist ideological framework.
Yeah, this is the this is the last chapter of the book. And in that chapter, I'm dealing with what happened to world history and world historians after the death of Mao. And in that chapter, I'm trying to argue a bigger argument that is a little bit beyond world history is 1980s was really a time of dynamics, creativity, and interesting conversations. In a way, I feel on the one hand, the historians in China were struggling with the remaining influence of ideological control directly from historical materialism and Marxism state ideology. On the other hand, the gradual lifting of censorship and ideological control in the 1980s, especially in the early 1980s, much so by the 1988, 89, right? That time, they were able to exercise relatively interesting ideas. And this is the time, in a way, historical study has now become highly specialized. This is a time culture became the theme of the conversation among intellectuals. So everybody was talking about culture. Everybody was talking about big ideas. Everybody was talking about the general dynamics of world historical changes. So in that case, it became an interesting moment for people to speak a lot, people from different perspectives, different positions, and different approaches to speak a lot about world historical issues. So this is very interesting. And in that process, we can observe a slow but a steady change in world historical writing in China. That is, the historians in China, especially world historians, they were very cautiously challenging the ideological framework that was defined by historical materialism. And the challenge was gradual, slow, but steady. So in the beginning, they were choosing several key issues that were already discussed in the 1950s. So for example, the question of the Asiatic mode of production, as I talked about right in the previous chapter. But gradually, they would move right these issues and gradually transform the conversation into louder critique or criticism of the ideological framework of historical materialism. So in the beginning, it was old topic. And you can say it's old bottle. But then gradually it started to pour in new wine, right? The new ideas started to pour in. And that is the process we're looking at, right? The gradual lifting of ideological control and the slow but steady challenge of historical materialism. And in that process, we can observe lots of dynamic conversation debates. So that's what I'm writing about in this chapter.
Thank you so much again. So for the last question today, I want to invite you to summarize the emergence of nationalism among Chinese world historians in the late 20th century.
Thank you very much. So this is something I wrote a little bit in the beginning, and I also wrote a little bit by the end of the book. The question here is nationalism is an important topic for this book. In a way, I would say this is an embedded theme for this book. But what I'm trying to do in this book is I'm trying to look at the other side of nationalism. In other words, I'm looking at the debate, the polemic of nationalism. I'm looking at the people who are trying to challenge nationalism in China, who are trying to write history from an alternative perspective to nationalism, right? I'm writing about world historians, and fundamentally, these world historians in China are not writing Chinese history. So they have to find a way to reconcile their global outlook and national identification, right? So in many ways in this book, right, we have lots of examples where in which people were challenging or trying to find alternative narratives to nationalistic and national history. But by the end, it seems that there is this revival, return, or resurgence of nationalism, especially among academic communities in China. And why so? That's something I've been thinking about a little bit in the concluding chapter. That is, in a way, the field of world historical studies, in a way, in the past few decades, or maybe 100 years also, there were always some dominant conversations, dominant themes that framed conversations. So for example, by the end of the 19th century, at the beginning of 20th century, a major issue is how do you deal with the legacy of Confucianism? And in the 1920s, 1930s, right, it is really about the issue of teaching and how does teaching of world history could contribute to China's entering the world, right? So China's entry into the world system. And 1950s is really about, you know, how do we understand Chinese revolution as a part of a global revolution? And so in other words, in the previous periods, we can see the scholars oftentimes, despite they were doing many different things, for the fact they were doing many different things, right? Still, there's a central framework of conversation. But by the 1990s, this framework seems to disappear. And maybe it's a good thing because we can see scholars in China became more and more specialized, professionalized. A lot of world historians in China now, they have foreign degrees and they studied with world-leading scholars and they were able to command languages, primary sources, so they are doing excellent work, for sure. But then somehow the conversation, the dominant theme that unified different approaches, right? The question that shapes the discipline disappeared. And because of the disappearance of the major or fundamental questions in the field, scholars' research became more and more fragmented. And in that process, people we can observe, right? It seems that nationalism, cultural nationalism, gradually found a way to sneak back in into the field of world historical studies. And of course, this is a ongoing project, right? So this is one book is far from enough solving all the questions, concerns, and summarizing all the debates and rethinking the legacies of world historical studies in the past. But that's at least what I'm trying to do at this moment. So in other words, what I'm trying to write about world history and the national identity is an issue that we're still dealing with. And in fact, the rise of nationalism in China today is a contingent issue, right? It is still in the process of change. And hopefully, by doing this project and by reading this book, you have a better understanding of what is the bigger context, right, for the rise of academic nationalism in China. That's what I'm trying to do.
Okay, thank you so much again for your answers. I mean, for all your answers to my questions. So at the end of our episode, I want to talk to my audience, to our audience. So as a Chinese historian, I think Dr. Fan's newest book, World History and National Identity in China, is one of the best, best book of the subject. And I'm very appreciate that. And I want to say, if anybody was interested in either the historiography of world history, in the history, modern Chinese history, you may consider buy a copy of Dr. Fan's newest book, World History and the National Identity in China. So thanks for your listening to our episode today. Thank you.
Thank you.